The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
I'm happy to introduce our next moderator, Lorena Perez, who is a council member and vice chair of the International Arbitration Law Committee of the Inter-American Bar Association. She is presently an attorney in the Department of Legal Services of the General Secretariat of the OAS. She has degrees from her home country, the Dominican Republic, and from Georgetown University Law Center. And she has practiced in the area of international arbitration before her present position at the OAS. So I leave you with Lorena.
Having some technical problems.
No.
There it is. Perfect. Thank you. Well, good morning, everybody. I want to thank the Washington College of Law once again, and American University, and Don Horacio Grijera and Susana Castiglione for helping us put together this program. Thank you to all of you for being here today for the program. I also wanted to make a pitch about the Inter-American Bar Association. I invite those of you who are not members of the IABA to join. We organize programs such as this one, and we co-sponsor and support programs of this type in various different places, as John said this morning, in Costa Rica, Miami, Texas, here in Washington. Many of the speakers that you have seen this morning are members of the Inter-American Bar Association. And we always need new people and new ideas to continue to grow as an organization. All right, well, we have heard this morning on procedural and evidentiary issues and about the current issues in Latin America. So now we're going to hear about current issues in international commercial arbitration in the U.S. and Canada. Although a little bit broader than that. We're going to cover a little bit more than that, but you'll see as this goes along. The panelists this morning, in the order that they will speak, are Jay Alexander, Luis Martinez, and Lucinda Lowe. Jay Alexander is a partner in the Washington office of Baker Botts, has over 20 years' experience in the resolution of international disputes. His practice at Baker Botts focuses on international arbitration and sophisticated litigation in the United States courts regarding cross-border disputes. He represents both sovereign states and foreign investors in investor-state disputes under bilateral investment treaties, as well as commercial entities and arbitrations conducted under the auspices of all the major arbitral institutes, including the ICC, the ICDR, and the LCIA. He's helped parties resolve disputes arising in many jurisdictions, including Brazil, Canada, China, Ecuador, Egypt, England, Israel, Jordan, Kazakhstan, Mexico, the Netherlands Antilles, Norway, Panama, Russia, South Korea, Spain, Switzerland, the United States, and Venezuela. Did I leave any countries out? I don't think I did. Jay is a member of the IABA and has been a speaker at many of our seminars and conferences on international arbitration. Today, he will be talking to us about manifest disregard of the law after Hall Street versus Mattel, 1 year later, what's happened, and about arbitration conflicts and the most recent draft ABA disclosures for arbitrators in commercial disputes, the one that was released just a few weeks ago, and also about the Arbitration Fairness Act of 2009. Luis is the Vice President of the International Center for Dispute Resolution, ICDR, the International Division of the AAA, and he is also the President of the IACAC, the Inter-American Commercial Arbitration Commission. He is an integral part of the ICDR's International Strategy Team, and he is responsible for international arbitration and mediation business development for the Northeast. That includes Washington, D.C., Maine, and New York City, and also for Central and South America. He has published several articles on international arbitration and also has appeared as a speaker in numerous programs throughout the world. He's an IABA member, and he is also a vice chair of the IABA International Arbitration Law Committee. Today, Luis will be speaking about the Arbitration Fairness Act of 2009 as well, but more from the institutional perspective. And he will also talk about the ICDR guidelines on arbitrators concerning exchanges of information and about Article 37 of the ICDR, International Dispute Resolution Procedures, the emergency measures of protection, and the recent cases invoking that article. Lucinda is a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Steptoe & Johnson, where she is a member of the International Department and heads the firm's Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, FCPA practice. Her practice focuses on U.S. and international anti-corruption laws, advising clients on matters ranging from preventive work to representation and internal investigations and enforcement matters worldwide. She is a widely recognized authority in FCPA and related international conventions from the OECD, OAS, United Nations, and the European Union. Lucinda has represented companies in World Bank investigations, audits, and sanctions proceedings in cases involving anti-corruption rules in World Bank-financed projects. She also has significant experience in investment disputes between foreign investors and host governments and commercial arbitration, including serving as counsel, arbitrator, and an expert witness. Today, she will talk about corruption issues in commercial arbitration and in investor state arbitration, including the enforcement of the FCPA. She'll talk about transparency and arbitration, including the Oncitral rules revision process, and about denunciations and limitations of consent from the investment arbitration and the implications for the arbitration of investment disputes. This panel presentation, the format is going to be informal. It's going to be of open discussion, so I guess we'll all sit here unless one of you feels comfortable to stand and make their presentation. We have a joint PowerPoint presentation where all the slides are going to talk about the issues that they're all going to be talking about. But feel free to, at any point, just walk to the microphone and wait for us to sort of make a signal so that you can make any questions you may have at any time during the presentation. And also, please state your name and your affiliation, if any, before when you talk in the microphone. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. As we turn to North America, I thought maybe a good place to start is at the beginning. And what I have on the screen is an excerpt from the will of George Washington. It's an appropriate place to start, both because we're at the Washington College of Law, but also because in addition to devising his assets and freeing his slaves, he included an arbitration clause. And you'll see at the end of his will, he provided that if there are any disputes, they shall be decided by three impartial and intelligent men known for their probity and good understanding. He then describes how they'll be chosen. And he goes on to say, such decision is, to all intents and purposes, to be as binding on the parties as if they had been given in the Supreme Court of the United States. It's the two issues that I'm primarily going to talk about today are the judicial review standard for arbitral awards. As you can see, George Washington had a much simpler view of it, and that would be that there are none. And second, the issue of arbitrator conflicts. And again, as you'll see, George Washington's view was fairly simplistic, and that is three impartial and intelligent men known for their probity and good understanding. The American Bar Association, as we'll see, is looking to provide far more details to that, which, as we'll discuss, may or may not be such a good idea. You may recall that last year the Supreme Court issued its decision in Hall Street versus Mattel. And in that case, which addressed whether or not parties could agree to increase the standards of review under the Federal Arbitration Act, the Supreme Court raised in dicta the question of whether or not the manifest disregard of law standard, which many circuits apply, is good law. The manifest disregard standard is essentially a standard that captures gross errors of law, something that is not expressly found within the contours of the review provisions of the Federal Arbitration Act. In the ensuing year, there have been roughly 40 decisions addressing Hall Street's dicta, about half of which dodged the issue altogether. Halliburton Energy is an example from the Fifth Circuit, simply finding that even if the manifest disregard standard still exists, the parties haven't, or this person seeking to review the award hasn't made it out, Several decisions, including the Hereford case from the Alabama Supreme Court, there's also a Vermont Supreme Court decision, have said that the manifest disregard standard does not survive Hall Street, and that review for essentially a gross abuse of law is no longer available. The remaining cases, including decisions from the Sixth, Second, and Ninth Circuits, take a somewhat middle ground. The Sixth Circuit holds that Hall Street does not undermine the manifest disregard precedent, but it defines the manifest disregard precedent in a relatively narrow way. Stolt-Nielsen and Comedy Club from the Second and Sixth Circuits do the same thing, finding in each of these three cases essentially that manifest disregard or gross misapplication of the law falls within the excess of power provision of the Federal Arbitration Act. Section 10A4 of the FAA provides that a arbitrator who exercises an excess of power will render his award non-viable. And so what these courts have held is that manifest disregard, although it is in fact a substantive standard, really falls within that excess of power. I submit that probably that may not have been what Congress had intended in the Federal Arbitration Act to create substantive judicial review provisions, but that is what these circuits are now finding. If we turn now to the issue of arbitrator conflicts, and this is, you know, where the arbitration starts and the appointment of the arbitrators. A fundamental attraction of arbitration, of course, is the ability to choose your own decision makers. It can lead to accidental appointment of arbitrators who have conflicts. It can be abused by appointing arbitrators who have known conflicts. All agree, and this is found in the New York Convention and in virtually every country of which I'm aware, that arbitrator partiality is a basis to vacate awards. In international arbitration, this is an issue of great concern. It's a great concern when particular countries adopt specific rules, because when you go to seek to enforce your award in that country, the rules of that country are going to be relevant under the New York Convention. And so the rules of any one country can have international implications to an arbitration conducted anywhere else. Certainly in the United States, courts have struggled with the issue of arbitrator partiality. Courts in California, courts in the Fifth Circuit have come up with a variety of standards and grounds for vacating awards on grounds of partiality that one might not anticipate in the abstract. In something that may be somewhat relevant, yesterday the Supreme Court heard argument in the case of Caperton versus Massey, which is a case involving the elected state judges, where the question there is, what is bias in the context of the judiciary? Depending on how the Supreme Court comes out on that decision, some of those standards may find spillover effect in the arbitration context. Now pending is what I believe to be the second draft of the ABA disclosure guidelines for arbitrators in commercial disputes. And what the ABA dispute resolution section has done is essentially come up with a set of guidelines that arbitrators should consider reviewing in the context of their appointment to decide whether or not they have a conflict of interest or a potential conflict of interest. The general standard in the guidelines is one that I think is generally sensible and I think few people would disagree with. But the devil, as always, is in the details. And I've pulled out some of the details on this slide. The first one, for example, that lawyer arbitrators should ask all of their partners and associates about any connection they would have with any party, counsel, or witness, and that any such connection should be disclosed. Non-lawyer arbitrators, folks who work in companies, for example, should review their company's customer lists, accounting ledgers, marketing files, and similar materials to find any connections. and disclose such. I mean, they're very unrealistic, from my perception, standards resulting or leading to, if they were to be followed, a tremendous volume of disclosure. If you go down near to the bottom, disclosing acquaintance-neighbor relationships, the commentaries to the guidelines refer to an example where you would need to disclose, if you were an arbitrator, the fact that your child attends a school where one of the witnesses' child attends, and you see that witness from time to time in the context of school functions. You need to disclose social relationships between your relatives, that being nuclear family, they define a fairly limited to parents, children, spouses, brother, sister. But social relationships with parties or lawyers, counsel, or witnesses. Again, the level of disclosures would be remarkable. The proposed guidelines explain that although they are intended as a tool to assist arbitrators decide what to disclose, and that they're not intended as a roadmap for losing parties to seek vacator, the truth of the matter is courts are constantly grasping and grappling for standards to apply. This would be a standard the ABA adopted, albeit for disclosure, that would provide a hook, particularly since one of the grounds that many courts look to for finding bias in an arbitrator in the vacator context is whether the arbitrator failed to disclose a potential conflict. And so the failure to disclose, the failure to identify and disclose the kinds of issues that the guidelines say arbitrators ought to look at simply raises the bar for, or lowers the bar, I would submit, for what is going to be grounds for vacature. If these standards are adopted, they will create enforcement risk. They may create, make the United States a less favorable place to seat one's arbitration. And they are, as I say, drafts and controversial. Comment period is open on these proposed rules, open until March 13th. And I think it is worth reviewing, particularly those of us who are in this field or want to enter it. Finally, I'll just speak briefly on the Arbitration Fairness Act of 2009, because Luis, I know, is going to spend some time on it as well. This is the successor. There was an Arbitration Fairness Act of 2007 that was not enacted. The stated objective is to avoid egregiously unfair mandatory arbitration clauses. In particular, it's focused on employment, consumer, franchise, and civil rights disputes. It's, you know, the legislatures are targeting, at least in their rhetoric, the little arbitration clause in the fine print on the back of your MasterCard contract, or in the contract when you purchase some good or buy a home. But the bill also includes some language that would impair the competence competence principle in the United States. And that is not limited, at least not by its express terms, to consumer and employment and franchise issues. But rather, it includes language that says the validity of enforceability of an arbitration, of an agreement to arbitrate, shall be determined by the court rather than the arbitrator. And that obviously flips or undermines dramatically the competence competence principle, which is essentially a principle that provides arbitrators have the first shot, have the right to decide in the first instance whether or not a dispute is arbitrable. And only thereafter, in the context of a review proceeding to vacate or confirm an award, do the courts have jurisdiction to address that, with the rare exception in the United States of gateway issues, gatekeeper issues. The Arbitration Fairness Act of 2009, as drafted, would appear to compromise that substantially by providing that the courts in the first instance would have the right to decide and would not or should not defer to the arbitral tribunal. Luis?
Well, thank you very much, Jay, and I do want to start by thanking the American University, Horacio Neon, and the IABA for the kind invitation to be here. As Jay mentioned, I am going to start off with a few additional comments on the Arbitration Fairness Act. From our perspective, we've been very concerned at the overall impact this act will have on commercial and primarily international arbitration here in the United States. We do recognize that there have been problems and abuses in those specific areas of consumer, franchise, and employment arbitrations. But the situation is that the way these cases have gone and the horror stories doesn't merit the idea of destroying the entire arbitral regime, the case law that we've amassed over 80 years, and the selection of the United States as a situs or a place to hold international arbitrations. Our policy has always been, and we recognize that there were problems years ago, that we do have to have some added protections for these people embarking in these consumer arbitrations, the credit card clauses, if you will, the franchise employment, the nursing homes. And we had, in fact, going back some time ago, had established due process protocols, where in essence, this was the AAA's, the American Arbitration Association policy on whether or not to accept these particular cases. In fact, we told many users over time that unless they complied, once the clause reached our doorsteps, if it wasn't in compliance, we would turn the case away, and we had done so for numerous cases. Our earlier position regarding this legislation was that perhaps what Congress should do is establish that our due process protocols for all these cases be universally adopted and applied by all the other administrators. There are numerous other administrators, as you know, in the United States who don't have these due process protocols and will accept most of the cases that come through their front doors, and that's where we've led to some of the abuses and the administration processes that we're not comfortable with. Now, I can tell you that the bills have been reintroduced, and we have on our webpage a certain section called ADR Commentary, which you're welcome to click on, and you can see our revised position now as to a suggestion for Congress in that the Federal Arbitration Act not be revised, but Title IX be a Section 4 added to it. This Section 4 will be specifically addressing the consumer, the employment, the nursing homes. I'm not sure about the franchises, but I have to check that. But it would be an additional chapter where they can, through legislation, build in all the protections, including perhaps the application of the due process protocols, and that will enable the other sections in the Federal Arbitration Act not to be touched or tampered with. It wouldn't deal with the competence issues, and they could really develop a customized regime just to deal with the concerns that are behind these particular caseloads. Now, having said that, we think that might draw some appeal. It is gaining some ground and interest. We do advise all of you in the international arbitration community to come to our webpage and see that position. One of the motivating groups behind this is obviously the group called the Americans for Justice, which is, as you know, the trial lawyers of this country who have always had an interest in moving from arbitration and getting these cases back, especially the class actions and the consumers, back in front of the juries and the courts. So perhaps this approach might be find some appeal with that group as well. We'll have to see how it works out. But right now I can tell you that things are moving quickly. Okay, from an institutional perspective, I'm just going to touch upon some new developments before I finish with a review of some recent Canadian law, arbitration law updates. First of all, the thing that we've seen has great appeal and is being used more and more right now was the revision we did in 2006 to add to our international rules an article that allows filing parties at the moment of filing to obtain and request the interim relief and have an emergency arbitrator appointed, again, at the time of filing. Procedures that we've adopted are different, for example, from what you've seen in the Institutional Model Laws approach, where they did allow these procedures to be done ex parte. We will not do them ex parte. The parties know that this system is done with notice to the other side. At the moment of filing, we can have the arbitrator appointed within 24 to 48 hours. He does or she does have to go through conflicts. She does go through the official appointment process. And the case is really a streamlined, fast process just to handle the specific request for emergency relief. It's usually done in documents only. There can be a telephonic hearing if necessary, and then the arbitrator will try to make his decision shortly thereafter. We're getting a lot of positive feedback from the users. The reason we implemented this process is because essentially without it, we left a hole in the desire of the parties' intentions to try to avoid each other's courts. Because as you know, during the regular process, it does take at least 60 days to have a panel appointed, and an international arbitration might take longer. So we felt we would try to create this mechanism where the parties could avail themselves and get the interim relief if needed. Now there's limitations, and we recognize there's limitations. As I stated before, it's not done ex parte. So if you feel, if you give notice to the other side, it'll destroy the application that you're trying to protect, whether it be the attachment or whether you're worried about assets being moved, then you still have the option to go to courts. You have to know that this process has some limitations. It's there, but basically if you think more than likely that the other side is working with you in good faith, that they'll comply voluntarily. And that's also the key. So far, we've had 7 of these cases filed with us since 2006. We did another approach to it in our rules as well, that we only apply these cases to contracts that were signed after the rule was revised. So we put everybody on notice. No one is blindsided because, as you know, sometimes they just put in the clause the rules that are currently in effect. So it would have to have been a contract that was signed after May 1st, 2006. I have 4 of the cases with me. We have 7 to date, but some examples where a UK party versus a US party, they wanted to enjoin the US party from using confidential hotel data, a client's list, and in that application it was granted by the emergency arbitrator. Keep in mind, another safety measure for this is that the tribunal, once appointed, can go back and revisit this emergency arbitrator's decision. They leave it in place, they can modify it or remove it. So the value of that, not only is that the tribunal can look at it, but there's also the idea that if you don't comply with this emergency arbitrator's ruling, that the tribunal is well aware of it and may or can or have the ability to draw negative inferences as to why you didn't respect the emergency arbitrator's decision, which is really the only policing power you have. The other case was a U.S. party versus a Norwegian party. In that case, the claimant wanted to enjoin the respondent from disclosing confidential website information that they were using in creating this website. And the arbitrator in that case denied the application, and the arbitrator said that it did not want to anticipate the decision on the merits and decided to keep the status quo. The third case was withdrawn, though. It was a U.S. party versus a Pakistani party. And the fourth was 2 major oil companies. I can't mention where they're from because of their identity. But one oil company wanted an order to prevent the removal of equipment from the other oil company pending the outcome of the arbitration. We've seen the average time 2 weeks to 3 weeks, and all voluntary compliance so far. So it's been a good development. I think it's now we at least have the complete product out there for parties if they're able to avoid each other's courts consistent with their expectation by putting an arbitration clause in the first place. The other thing we were concerned of, and it still continues to be a concern, is the costs and time that we're seeing in international arbitration. The way that international arbitration each year seems to resemble litigation more and more. And we're taking many steps to counter this. It's part of our way of identifying our institutional policies and expectations. So when people select our rules, they get an idea of what this institution believes are the proper ways, for example, under our system to administer international arbitration. One of the things we're doing is really drawing a line in the sand and trying to limit discovery. to a certain extent. We've started this off by promulgating a new set of guidelines on information exchange. These guidelines were sent in a letter to all the arbitrators who are admitted to our international panels, and it's the idea that they have a duty to try to be more proactive and assert themselves into trying to limit these discovery requests along the lines of what the IBA did when it promulgated its set of guidelines on evidence. In this case, we went a little bit further. We did specify that the arbitrators do have a duty under document production to make sure that these requests are relevant and material. We do want to not allow these broad fishing expeditions, if you will. In e-discovery, and by the way, there was so much internal struggle, and I think there'll be more because we recognize that these are only guidelines and that international arbitrators would be much more comfortable if they were included in the rules, because the guidelines always opens them up to the idea, well, they're just guidelines and perhaps I limit this request, and now the next thing I know, the award is being challenged for failing to allow a party an opportunity to present its case. So we do expect to revise the rules, but I don't know if the guidelines in their present form will be incorporated in the rule revisions, and that's an ongoing extensive project. E-discovery concerns us tremendously. We didn't go as far as to say it shouldn't be used, but we did say, again, it should be narrowly focused, and we do want to avoid, as mentioned, the fishing expeditions. We mentioned that depositions and other discovery tools were generally not appropriate for international arbitration. For the attorney-client privilege, we set a guideline for the arbitrator that the most protective privilege amongst the parties from different traditions should be held to apply to all parties. The tribunal, we again advise them of our institutional expectation that they have a view to maintain efficiency and economy of process and avoid unnecessary delay. This is a constant back and forth that the institution has with the arbitrators to make sure that that message is clear, and never more important than it is today with this economic crisis. I can tell you, I remember several months ago that people in our field were saying that there was going to be a deluge of filings of cases as a consequence of this economic crisis. It has not appeared to be the case. Our January filings were consistent with last year, but what has dropped is the larger cases, the multi-million dollar disputes, where we are hearing that companies are sort of in a holding pattern, really analyzing whether to file a case, trying to gauge the costs of going after that claim, and perhaps waiting to see how things shake up in the economy. As we all are waiting, companies are doing the same thing. So I don't think we're going to see that deluge. I think we're going to be lucky to ride out the storm and see what happens. But that's my personal opinion, not the AAA's ICDR. We'll see how that shakes out. And finally, we did advise the arbitrators that they do have, pursuant to our rules, the authority to manage the case effectively and efficiently. So we're hoping that is the first, shall we say, shot across the bow that the ICDR slash AAA in its international system is trying to push back with these broad discovery requests. I'll move on to Canada, not my particular area of expertise, but we do have a Canadian team, and I do want to highlight some of the cases that they told me you'd find interesting. I'll start off with a recent case called the Ubenrath Corp. Russian versus Rex Alberta. I don't have slides on it, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
And it was an Alberta Supreme Court decision where they decided that the two-year period to apply to enforce international arbitration awards would be held. In this case, the Russian party wanted to enforce the award after 3 years, and the Alberta court decided that it would apply the same standards as it does for sentences, judicial sentences. So they did not allow the Russian party to bring the enforcement proceeding. Granted that in that case it doesn't apply to all the jurisdictions in Canada, but we just recently, as of yesterday in fact, Global Arbitration Review reports that the case will be taken by the Canadian Supreme Court, so we'll see whether the two-year statute applies to enforce international awards. I think this was also, by the way, an ICC case. It was a $1 million against Rex, an Alberta province corporation. Now, as far as in general, the arbitration clauses in Canada continue to be interpreted broadly. I will say it is a very good jurisdiction for us in terms of international filings. That is the largest filer of our international cases, with Mexico following shortly right behind that. And the Canadian courts continue to demonstrate that they're going to interpret arbitration clauses broadly. They're going, just recently reaffirmed in the Court of Appeal case for the province of Ontario in Greenfield Ethanol versus Suncor Energy Products. And the issue is the interpretation of an arbitration clause in a long-term supply agreement of ethanol, and they did apply it. Now, there have not been, I asked the question because I knew we were going to talk about Hall Street, there haven't been any Canadian decisions on the party's ability to vary the scope of judicial review of arbitral awards since U.S. Supreme Court decisions. Interestingly, most Canadian provinces have adopted the UNCITRAL model law in their Article 34, which determines the scope of judicial review. And the leading Canadian decision on these cases regarding the ability to change the scope of review is the 1998 decision of the Ontario Court, now the Ontario Superior Court of Justice, Noble China versus Lei, L-E-I. And the court held that parties can contract out of provisions of the model law that are not mandatory, and that provisions for judicial review are not mandatory. So we see a difference there. Supreme Courts of Canada have decided that arbitration clauses preclude class arbitrations, and they do respect the doctrine, obviously, of competence, and it is applied broadly in that jurisdiction. That was also reaffirmed in the case, the Dell Computer case versus Union des Consommateurs. In that case, Dell put out an ad announcing 500 computers at a ridiculously low price, and they didn't want to honor that mistake. And it was brought to arbitration, and the courts have accepted that case. As I can't see if a decision has been rendered yet. Other developments for Canada is that Canada has moved to implement the ICSID convention. We understand it is going through ratification. Has it been ratified yet? Not completely, so it's still in the process. And lastly, just a few, am I okay for two more minutes? Okay, a couple of quick other developments that we did last year. You may or may not know that the ICDR AAA is one of the founders of the International Mediation Institute based in Europe. I believe it's in the Netherlands. And the idea behind this IMI Institute is to put together a process for the certification of mediators. It is one of the things that over years we've encountered many people perhaps erroneously exaggerate their expertise as mediators or their qualifications. We have a process which you can go to their website and you can see how you can be a certified IMI mediator and establish clearly your credentials through a set of series and tests that they are now introducing and finalizing for the marketplace. There's been a lot of debate because people, mediators of extensive reputation, are saying that they feel almost compelled and forced to be a certified IMI mediator because the market is embracing this certification. Our policy and view is that, look, at the end of the day, we're trying to create higher and better and consistent standards on who are qualified, certified mediators, and we think that can only help international mediation in general, which to this date we still haven't seen the kind of growth that we continue to hope to see in the future. Technology continues to be a driving force for us in the last 2 years. Extensive work on, you can now file all your cases with us online, the documents and the whole process can be done online. Arbitrators have their own pages called the E-Neutral Center where they can anywhere in the world update their curriculum vitae, manage their calendar, include their billing, and that's being enhanced as well. So we're going to see a new ICDR website by 2010 with many more exciting bells and whistles, but all designed really to help all the stakeholders from our arbitrators to our users and to the institutional administration. I think I've used enough of my time, but thank you very much for your attention.
It sounds like you are covering everything very well because there are no questions from the audience. So now it's Lucinda's turn. I actually forgot to mention that Lucinda is the chair of the, I'm going to say it wrong, the ad hoc committee of the IABA on corruption.
And money laundering. All those good things.
Exactly.
All those good things. Thank you, Lorena, and thanks to the Washington College of Law and Horacio for putting together this very interesting program. It's a pleasure to be here and see some old friends on other panels and in the audience. So,
this works.
Yes. I'm going to talk about three things some of which have more connection to each other than might be apparent at first blush. First, I'm going to talk about corruption issues in arbitration, both in the commercial context and in the investor-state context. Second, I'm going to talk about the move to introduce more transparency into arbitration, and in particular, the ongoing revision to the Insitral rules. And finally, time permitting, although this was a topic that the last panel talked about quite a bit, we'll come back to denunciations and withdrawals from investment arbitration. Now, in terms of corruption issues in arbitration, Lorena described my practice to you at the outset, and these used to be two very disparate streams of practice that were united only by the fact that they all involved the interaction of international business and foreign governments. Sometimes foreign governments gone bad in the case of corruption, and sometimes the kinds of disputes and government policy decisions that lead to investment disputes. But in fact, these two issues have come together to a very significant extent in recent years. And they're particularly coming together for investors and parties in the countries that this panel focuses on, the U.S. and Canada. And why is that? Well, a lot has happened in the corruption arena that is being brought to bear in the arbitration context, both commercial claims and investor-state claims. The U.S. has long had a law, a highly extraterritorial law that affects, can impose liability for corruption in international business, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. That law is being enforced today to an extent we've never seen. Siemens, a company we'll come back to, just settled the largest corruption case that has ever happened for combined penalties in the U.S. and Germany of $1.6 billion. Halliburton recently settled a case involving its former subsidiary, Kellogg Brown & Root, for penalties of almost $600 million. So staggering penalty levels for corruption issues abroad. And one feature of this law is a vicarious liability standard for the actions of third parties that can make a company responsible for what its agents do, its consultants, its partners, and other third parties. And that has relevance to our topic, as we'll see. In addition to this U.S. statute, we're also seeing many countries that have adopted similar statutes in recent years. Canada has a statute that's almost identical to the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act that it enacted a few years ago. Germany has a statute that was the basis for the German prosecutions, and dozens of other countries, as well as an increase in host country concern about issues of bribery and corruption. Many countries have new investigative bodies, prosecutorial bodies, such as the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission in Nigeria and in other countries. And so all of this is giving rise to many investigations and proceedings, which as we'll see, can come back and have an impact on disputes. We also have the emergence of international standards through a series of treaties that have been adopted and gone into force and achieved wide adherence in just a few years. And these treaties, among other things, require countries to cooperate with each other in the investigation and prosecution of offenses. So suddenly evidence that may have been under the control of the Swiss authorities, information about what is in someone's Swiss bank account, suddenly is not so difficult to get. as it used to be. And that is fueling this increase in enforcement. Now, how does this play out in arbitration? First, if you take the commercial side, international commercial arbitration, typically it may come up as a defense to a payment claim. For instance, you have, let's take a U.S. company had an agent in a foreign country, becomes concerned about conduct that that agent may be engaging in connection with the party's relationship, terminates the agent and refuses to pay commissions to the agent that the agent claims are due. That kind of scenario can lead and has led to a number of arbitration claims from these terminated agents, sometimes litigation as well, but often the contracts have arbitration clauses, and I've been involved in a number of these cases. So the company may defend against the claim on a variety of grounds. Well, there's been a fundamental change here since these issues started coming up in arbitration. And that change is really dependent on the party's foresight or the respondent's foresight when it drafted the contract. In the old days when these issues first started arising, the contract wouldn't necessarily have any provisions in it that would purport to govern how the agent should behave in this regard. And so if an issue came up and the respondent wanted to resist a claim, it had to resist on the grounds that payment of the commission would violate public policy. Well, there were very mixed results decisions of arbitral tribunals in the 80s and 90s on these issues. A famous opinion of Judge Lagergren of Sweden some years back, where he found that it was a public policy defense to a claim, but other tribunals, such as in the very well-known Westacre case in the UK, not giving effect to a public policy defense. But the ground has shifted, and with the advent of contractual clauses that may impose very detailed obligations on a third party, for instance, obliging them not to engage in bribery or corruption, and even providing for certain remedies, such as the withholding of payments that would otherwise be due and owing in the event of the discovery of such conduct. These cases are more today turning on issues of contractual interpretation without the need to get into the thicket of public policy. Now, the fact is that I think the public policy landscape has shifted dramatically with the growth of these international standards, and it is far less likely today that a tribunal would have difficulty finding that public policy should deny recovery of a claim, the difficulty that's still presented today is that there are evidentiary challenges. Often it is very difficult for a respondent to know precisely what an agent has done. Sort of by definition, they will do it under the table. They will do it in secret. And you may have indications of possible misconduct, but perhaps not certainty regarding the conduct. So that's an area where it is still a very difficult issue for companies, because they may terminate in effect on a prudential basis, being concerned that the agent has engaged in improper conduct, but perhaps without having definitive evidence, only to be faced with a claim. So those are some of the cases that are starting to come today, and I'll come back to this issue of evidence because gathering evidence of this type is an issue even in criminal proceedings. It is a much more difficult issue for arbitral panels to grapple with the more limited set of tools they have to gather evidence and some of the pressures and constraints that my colleague Louise just alluded to. Let me turn then to the investment dispute side. We've been talking about international commercial arbitration, but these issues are also coming up with increasing frequency in investment disputes between foreign investors and host governments. And here the posture is not universally, but most frequently, that the issue of corruption is raised, or fraud, is raised by a host government as a defense to a claim for recovery by a foreign investor. And you can see there are a host of recent cases where either fraud in the inducement or corruption have been raised in a number of cases with success by the respondent in these cases. My own personal favorite is the World Duty Free v. Kenya case, not jurisdictionally within the U.S. or Canada, but a case where the evidence of corruption came from an affidavit that the principal shareholder of the claimant had submitted in connection with proof of its claim, where he essentially admitted that he'd made a $2 million payment to the president of Kenya, which he subsequently sought to justify on cultural grounds as harambee. The tribunal had little patience for that argument. There has been, in a number of these cases, dismissals of the investor's claim for lack of jurisdiction. And that seems to be the trend, where there is clear evidence that the very rights on which the investor is claiming were secured by some actions of corruption or fraud. Now, I mentioned Siemens earlier when I was talking about the increase in criminal enforcement and the size of the recent Siemens settlement. Siemens is also an interesting example of the interaction of criminal enforcement and arbitration, because Siemens, as some of you may know, has had an ICSID claim pending for some time as a result of the Argentine government's cancellation of an identity card, national identity card project that it had won through a government procurement some years back. That case had proceeded to a hearing. There had been an award in favor of Siemens, a large award of a couple hundred million dollars. The government, during the course of the proceeding, had sought to introduce evidence of Siemens' suspected corruption, but there were issues as to the timeliness of that and the sufficiency of the evidence, and that effort failed. However, after the award was rendered, the corruption case broke. And that's a fascinating story in and of itself, which I won't go into in detail, but it ended up being a worldwide investigation of Siemens operations, including touching on this project in Argentina. And when the case was settled at the end of last year by concurrent settlements between the U.S. and the German authorities, it wasn't only Siemens AG, the ultimate parent company, that pled guilty and agreed to pay fines, but in the United States settlement, three foreign subsidiaries of Siemens also pled, one of them being Siemens Argentina, pled guilty and agreed to pay a fine. And in fact, the Department of Justice's press release with regard to this matter specifically criticized the company for not providing evidence of its corruption in this project to the ICSID tribunal. And so the ICSID process, the status right now is that before the settlements there had been an annulment tribunal constituted, but that that tribunal suspended its proceedings last summer by agreement of the parties, and now the original tribunal has been reconstituted and is hearing an application from the Argentine government for a revision of the award. The government presumably is relying on the evidence that has now been brought forward as a result of the criminal prosecution. I won't try to predict what will happen, but I think there's a fair chance that that $200 million award is not going to stand. So you can see the interaction that is occurring between enforcement proceedings and arbitration proceedings. Now, I will say with regard to the jurisdictional approach that I described, that is the decisions that have been rendered by a number of tribunals to date in INSESA and World Duty Free and others not to let claims of investors go forward on a theory of lack of jurisdiction, that this jurisdictional approach can raise some significant issues in particular cases, depending on the facts. It may be appropriate where there is really fraud or corruption in the actual securing of the rights, so that you can take the position that the rights were never validly secured. But what happens if there's been performance? These are often large, long-term projects. What if the corruption was 10 years ago and the company's gone on to build an airport or a water system or some other facility that the government, host government, has the use and enjoyment of? What should the tribunal do then? Is dismissal really the appropriate remedy? What should a tribunal do with the complicity of host country officials, which of course does happen? It takes two to tango in these things, and so the facts may show that the investor initiated the corruption. The facts may show otherwise. How to weigh that? How to weigh if it's the very same government defending and trying to repudiate the contract on these grounds as whose officials were involved in the corruption? These are very difficult issues, and the tribunals haven't begun to deal with them. What happens if there's not fraud in the inducement or corruption in the securing of rights, but something more collateral? Paying customs agents to get product into the country in connection with performance of the project. Surely that should not be the basis for a dismissal. And how to take into account the lapse of time. These are some of the issues that future tribunals are going to have to deal with. And again, we have fact-finding challenges. Some of the same difficulties that commercial arbitration tribunals have in getting to the facts underlying these very complex issues are certainly presented in the international context as well. We may see more situations where tribunals decide that they're going to stay their proceedings pending the running the course of any government investigations or national enforcement proceedings that may bring out the facts. Something like what happened in the SGS v. Philippines case, if you're familiar with that. So I think this is an issue that is only going to occupy investment tribunals more and more. And we're also going to be seeing as an issue in international commercial arbitration. Now, in my last couple of minutes, do I have a couple more minutes? I have 2 minutes. Okay. Then I'll just mention quickly the revisions to the UNCITRAL rules and the issue of transparency. There has been a project underway for a couple of years now within UNCITRAL to revise and update their rules, which have been in place since 1976. And as a result of that effort, several NGOs, non-governmental organizations, saw the opportunity to push for the institution of a series of transparency measures into these rules, not terribly dissimilar to some of the things that were reflected in the most recent ICSID rule revisions, including notice of filing of a case, notice of what the issues are in a case, the opportunity for open hearings, the opportunity for third interested parties to file amicus briefs, and transparency with respect to decisions and awards. Now, their particular interest in these transparency measures really arises from the investment dispute context and the public policy issues they see those disputes raising. The challenge in the UNCITRAL context, as we know, under most bilateral investment treaties, UNCITRAL is one of the options for arbitration and is preferred to exit arbitration by some parties in some countries. But it's also, of course, a set of rules that is used for international commercial arbitration. And this proposal of the NGOs met substantial pushback from the UNCITRAL community because of the very significant international commercial component of use of those rules and the importance historically that confidentiality has had to the success of international commercial arbitration. Result of that discussion, if you will, was that the Commission itself took a decision in 2008 to go ahead with a revision of its rules and put this issue of what to do as far as transparency and investment disputes really on a separate track to be taken up after the main project is finished. So that's where that issue stands. I see John Crook in the audience. He and I have been part of a study panel of the American Society of International Law and the American branch of the International Law Association on these transparency issues. And I think it's fair to say that after both public dialogue and internal dialogue within the study group, these are far more complex issues than some may have appreciated at the beginning. So more to say on that later, but that's what's going on in UNCITRAL. I think I'll leave the issue of denunciation since the prior panel went into that in some detail.
Spoke about it. Thank you so much. I believe that you have
a... Well, just one quick announcement that I forgot to mention. I have attended the meetings of the American Law Institute's work on the restatement of the U.S. law on international arbitration. I'd invite all of you who are interested to view their first draft. It's on their website. I don't know if it's ALI. I think it's ALI.org, but if not, Google American Law Institute. It's really their first draft. They're now accepting comments, and if you want the comments on some of the various sections, it's a very interesting first draft, and there's a lot of debate and discussion regarding the next draft. So feel free to look up and see their work.
And I guess the questions and answers are going to be during lunch, right? Because we don't have no time left. Yes, exactly. Okay. Any takers? See, no questions. Oh, there's one. Yes.
I think I've been speaking to Deputy. My name is Marcelo Real. I'm at Sloan in Brazil. Would you say there is affirmative obligation on the part of our trades if they come across allegations or even evidence of corruption in commercial arbitration?
Uma pergunta muito interessante. It's a very interesting question, I'm not aware of any such obligation in any of the governing the institutional rules. One does also have to consider in this circumstance whether national law may apply, particularly the law of the seat of the arbitration. There are some countries that impose disclosure obligations on parties that become aware of corruption. And so there is a threshold question, I think, of applicable law. I think my own view would be that you would look first and foremost to the laws that govern the duties of the arbitrators, which would be found in the rules of the arbitral institution. But I'd invite others on the panel to comment on this. Jay looks like he has a thought.
Well, the only thing I would say is that there has been some issues or concerns about this in the context of some of the English laws that require anybody with knowledge of certain offenses, whether they be lawyers even, to disclose to the Serious Fraud Office.
Right.
And one would plainly argue that that would equally apply to the arbitrator.
But I think the response to that under the Proceeds of Crime Act, as I understand it, which is the governing UK statute, and it really comes out of EU anti-money laundering laws, is that reporting obligations for lawyers typically arise when they're acting in the context of a transaction, a financial transaction, a real estate matter, and not, for instance, when they're advising in the litigation context. So these are issues that are going to continue to be debated.
I believe there are no more questions.